Well, welcome back. How many were here last night? Wow, how many were not here last night? Oh my goodness, wow. Well, I gotta start over then, right? Okay, I'll do a summary for everybody in just a moment, but let me say something about this Joshua Institute. Now, I don't have any direct connection with it, but I've had a number of years now experience with Hume, and I know the way they do the work. And I have a lot of experience with apologetics and with dealing with people who are going out from the church into the community. And I'll tell you one thing, we have heard enough stories, too many stories, about students coming out of Christian homes who love the Lord and going out into the university and getting eaten alive and coming back at Christmas vacation or Thanksgiving vacation. And they have been disabused of all of the confidence they had in Christ by what they confronted in the university scene. And the idea of having a gap year, in other words, having kids that come out of high school and before they go into that arena, having a year of intensive training added to what you're already doing in their lives to solidify them in Christ and to strengthen them and to give them cross-cultural experience. I'm telling you, this is such a fabulous idea. There are a number of gap programs around, but you know, the Hume program, Hume is a big operation. They are well capitalized. They know how to do these things. And how long is the program up there?
It's a year long.
How long has it been going? How many years?
99, I think.
Oh, so it's been going for quite a while now. Okay. And they got a marvelous facility. If you haven't been up there, you just got to go up there. Tomorrow morning, they got the tour and everything. Just take a look at it. Now, my eldest is 12, so I got 6 years to work on her. She's a little bit of an introvert, but I want to work on her so that she wants to come and take a gap year because I'm really in favor of this kind of thing. So that's just my pitch for this. Now, yesterday, this series is called The Most Encouraging Talk You've Never Heard, all right? And the first three sessions, including last night and then these two here, tonight and tomorrow, I think that's an appropriate way to characterize it because of my experience with this material has been so many people have come up to me afterwards, either after hearing the material and using it or especially after reading the book that deals with it because it's much more thorough, or maybe going through the online course that Sandra just put out on tactics. They have come back to me and they've told me, and really excited, this has changed my life. It has changed my ability to engage others in a productive fashion for the cause of Christ. It has made my conversations with other people a lot more genial. It has made the engagements look more like diplomacy than D-Day, and that's one of the things that I'm after. And they've actually said, I find this is more fun for me now to talk to other people about Christ than it ever has been before. And yesterday I laid out a little bit of the foundation of the general approach. So for the sake of review for those of you who are here and also bringing the rest of you up to speed, let me tell you a little bit about it. I mentioned to the group that I had a bit of a epiphany about 15 years ago. For me, coming out of the Jesus movement with the aggressive evangelistic approach of the Jesus movement and evangelicalism being heir to that approach now largely, the idea that you go out to share Christ and the goal is to win someone to Christ. So you're looking for decisions that people make for Christ. Nothing wrong with that, but we're facing a culture that is a lot more resistant to that kind of thing now than it was 40 years ago, okay? And the resistance is a whole lot more sophisticated in terms of the challenges that are being raised against Christianity. That's one of the things that keeps Stand to Reason, the organization that I work for, in existence because we're part of a larger team of Christians that are providing answers for these challenges. But you also got to look at the pushback, the hostility that's coming out of the culture now. It's a whole lot more than it ever was. And so the idea of engaging that culture for Christians is really frightening, okay? They don't want to get in fights. They don't want to get in conflict. And if it looks like that, they're going to sit on the bench. And for a lot of us, inheriting this other way of doing evangelism you know, kind of getting out there, sharing the gospel, the simple gospel, if you will. I mentioned yesterday the simple gospel is no longer simple. People don't understand the words that you're talking about. Culture has changed. But sharing that, looking to win someone to Christ, this sounds like conflict to a lot of people, and so they're just going to stay away. What that means is a whole bunch of folk are sitting on the bench when we need the whole team in the field. And the insight that I had a number of years ago, given that field, and Jesus said in John chapter 4 to the disciples, you know, after he talked with the woman at the well, she's off to Sychar, the disciples come in with some food, and he says to them, you say there is 4 months and then comes the harvest. I say to you, look on the field, it is ripe for harvest. Now, it's white for harvest is what he said. He's probably referring to the white robes of the people coming across the field being led by the woman at the well to bring them to this prophet who told her everything she's ever did. That was her testimony. So they're all wound up. They're ready to go. And Jesus is telling the disciples they're about to get the easy pickings. You are about to reap where you did not sow. Now, just an observation about that event there in John 4. I do not think that Jesus was saying that every field is white for harvest. I think he was saying that field was ripe for harvest. And some fields are not as ripe for harvest, okay? And so the easy pickings take some time. But I pointed out something yesterday about that passage, and this is part of my insight that I got, is that there's one field, one team, but there are two types of workers. There are ones who harvest, and that's what was going to happen at that time. But there were the ones who prepared for the harvest. There were the harvesters, and there were also the gardeners. And the insight I had was, before there can be any harvest in any individual's life, there's got to be a season of gardening. Let me say that again. Before that any individual is harvested for the kingdom's sake, there is going to be a season of gardening in that person's life to bring them to that point. And I'm suggesting that nowadays the season is a lot longer in any individual's life than it ever was before, at least in our memory. Okay, now that doesn't mean that the Holy Spirit can't grab somebody and turn them around just like that, and it does happen, but it's rare. Okay, normally it just takes a lot of what Francis Schaeffer used to call pre-evangelism to get a person to a point of considering the gospel. And when I realized that, I realized, well, there's two seasons and two kinds of workers. I began to look at my own life as a follower of Christ, now 44 years almost, and also my professional life as a Christian worker, and I realized that really what I do most of the time is garden. I really don't do much harvesting. I do a lot of gardening, and I realize that's fine with me. I'm not getting a lot of individual people to pray to receive Christ. Some people are really good at that, but that's not what I do. And so when I face an audience, and I've spoken on more than 70 college and university campuses, when I address an audience like that, I'm not looking for people to raise their hands. You know, I see that hand, every eye bowed and head closed. That's the way it is a lot of times when you're speaking. Their head is closed and their eyes are bowed. And, you know, like that. No, I'm there and I tell them, I'm just there to do a little gardening is what I'm thinking. But what I say to them is, I'm not there to convert you. I just want to put a stone in your shoe. I just want to annoy you a little bit in a good way. I want to get you thinking, because I think Jesus of Nazareth is worth thinking about. And then I go into my lecture, my talk, whatever it happens to be. But my own attitude is, I'm just going to try to move people along. I'm not going to try to go for the gold, especially when it's not appropriate in the moment. Now, some people differ with that, and I understand people who are harvest-minded and maybe good at that, they don't like what I just said. And I got pushback. I mean, Josh McDowell gave me a really hard time about this. He just gave me a tongue lashing on, but I'm going to stick with it because I have seen the results in people's lives when I encourage them to think not in terms of going for the gold, getting the decision, but doing a little gardening instead. And pardon me mixing all the metaphors here, but you get the point. But just to do a little bit, make that your aim, and then I give you some tools that allow you to do that. People get really excited. And then when they start doing it, then they come back to me and they say, oh my gosh, this has changed everything for me. Now, I don't think just having a couple of nights together is going to do that for you. I want to encourage you to think about getting the book, Tactics, a Game Plan for Discussing Your Christian Convictions. Because you know how it is when you're up at camp and you hear a talk, you get fired up, you go down the hill and, what was that guy's name? What did he talk about? So you got to kind of be a student of this a little bit. But hopefully what I'll do is give you basics here that you can begin to employ right away, and then that'll encourage you to maybe go a little deeper. And if you make this part of your lifestyle, I promise it'll change everything. And so what I said to last evening, the promise that I made to the group then, and I just extend it to the rest of you who are here today, given the modified goal I'm suggesting you to take, the modified goal being, let's not swing for the fences, let's just, as my view, you don't even have to get on base. You just want to get in the batter's box. And I'm going to give you a tool that allow you to do that. If you think about, let's just do a little gardening, whatever, then my promise is I'm going to give you a tool that will allow you to converse with confidence in any situation. No matter how little you know, or how knowledgeable, or aggressive, or even obnoxious the other person happens to be. And I mentioned yesterday that this game plan, the tactical game plan that I'll outline here today and tomorrow, now in detail, follows a directive that Paul offers in Colossians chapter 4, verse 5 and 6. And here's what Paul says there. He says, conduct yourself with wisdom towards outsiders, making the most of the opportunity. Okay, so first he says, be smart. Then he says, let your speech always be with grace, okay? Seasoned as it were with salt. So we're not looking to fight. We're not looking to get into arguments. Paul tells Timothy, the Lord's bondservant should not be argumentative, but rather patient when wronged, you know? With patience trying to correct those who are in opposition. So we're not to fight. So Paul says, Be smart, be nice. Okay, this is a really important part of this. Be nice. For some of you, that comes easier than other people, you know. And then he says in the Colossians passage, so you know how to respond to each person. That is, we are dealing with people as individuals. We are paying attention to the individual set of circumstances that the person is in. Okay, so be smart, be nice, be tactical. Okay, and this is where the game plan comes in. Let me just say something about this be nice part. This is one of the reasons that 24 years ago we started Stand to Reason, is because there was the thinking in Christian circles was really shallow when it comes to spiritual things. And we had the best things to think about, and we've got the best people and the best training and the best history of Christian thinking available to us. Why is it that we are doing so little with it? So we wanted to reintroduce that, make it available to the body of Christ. Secondly, though, there was too much shrillness, too many people arguing, banging heads. When we did engage, those that were bold enough to engage, it got really messy really quickly. And so it wasn't productive. And so we wanted to try to bring more of an ambassadorial approach to the whole enterprise. We want to train ambassadors in the area of knowledge, wisdom, and character. And here, wisdom, I mean tactical wisdom, the ability to maneuver well. And we have seen that that model has been really, really effective. Okay, now at Stand to Reason, we have lots of different tactics that we promote. And they're in the book. They have names like Suicide and Just the Facts, Ma'am, and Rhodes Scholar, and you know, things like that. So steamroller. And these are all different maneuvers that you can learn to use in conversations that can be really effective to help people get them thinking about their own views in a productive way. But there is one tactic that is the core of the game plan. It is the game plan itself, really. And all the rest of the tactics are meant to serve that, okay? And the tactic has a name, and the name is Columbo, after Lieutenant Columbo. Now, those of you who were not here last night, you missed the trench coat and the cigar and the little routine that I do, Lieutenant Columbo style. You know, something about this thing bothers me, you know. So you missed that, and I'm not going to do it again. Too bad. He who, If you're late, you perish, or however that works. I don't know. But he who hesitates is lost. You weren't here. But I'll tell you what, the thing about Columbo and what made him so effective was his, in a certain sense, his modest demeanor. People didn't take him seriously at first. He wasn't scary. This guy's stupid, but he's stupid like a fox, right? Because he's got a system. And what he does, you know, is he asks questions. And he starts mildly and drawing people out. And the questions allow him to get a lot of information. And then his mind is going like crazy because he's paying attention to the answers. And then this puts him in a position to solve the problem. But he does it all the time with more questions. Okay? So the key to the Columbo tactic, which is the core of the game plan, is that the Christian goes on the offensive in an inoffensive way with carefully selected questions that advance the conversation. Okay? Now, remember I said this is a game plan. That means there are steps to it, and that makes it easy. And some people they don't really like the kind of mechanical approach where you do this, then you do this, then you do this. But trust me on this. This is easy. And it's not mechanical in its execution. It's just step by step to make it easy for you to remember how to do it, okay? And when I say game plan, step one, what I want you to be thinking about is employing that when you find yourself in a circumstance where you hope to have a spiritual impact. Maybe you meet a stranger, you sit next to him on the airplane. That's what I do a lot. Maybe you have friends that you want to talk to more about the Lord than you have. Maybe you've got your crazy Uncle Harry who shows up at Thanksgiving. He's the atheist and makes a mess of things. You know, well, so, you know, all kinds of different circumstances. Now you're thinking, how can I begin to be more effective there? When I say the game plan, step one, what I want you to think about is just the first step. I don't want you to think about two or three. I don't want you to think about leading anybody to Christ. In fact, I mentioned yesterday, controversially to some, that I never have it as a goal to lead anybody to Christ. I don't, and when I get in a conversation, I'm not looking to lead them to Christ. I don't have it as a goal to even give them the gospel at that moment. I don't know if that's the right thing for them at that moment. You might think, well, how could the gospel not be the right thing? If they don't understand the terminology, if they don't understand their need. You know, Jesus didn't give the gospel every time he interacted. Think of the rich young ruler. That guy went away discouraged, right? And lots of times that was the case with Jesus, okay? So there, instead of having a cookie cutter approach, we give like three principles to get saved. And here, you want to pray with me? Sometimes that's appropriate. But a lot of times, maybe just working on one idea to get a person to understand it or to begin to consider it, maybe that's the thing that you need to be doing. Getting them to doubt their own convictions about something that's getting in the way for Christianity. That's a little, you just pulled, if you can do that, what'd you just do? You just put a little what? Stone in their shoe. Or using another metaphor, you just pulled a little weed. Is that progress? Of course that's progress. You don't have to go the whole distance is what I'm saying. If we lower the goal and we use our game plan and we just kind of begin to get into play and take the first step, then we can see if there's opportunity for a second step. We don't know. I don't think that every single encounter is a divine appointment. That is not my view. Sometimes we're just ships passing in the night. Other times, especially if we're alert and we just, you know, toss out a little bait. You know, I'm a fisherman, you know, so I was like, see if you get any followers, you throw some chum out. If you're a saltwater fisherman, that's what you do. You throw out a little bait in the water and see if the fish come up and grab the freebies. And then you throw out a piece of bait with a hook in it, you know, and then you hope you get the fish. Well, sometimes you're just doing that and you see if you attract some attention. You know, I was discipled by a guy named Craig Englert when I first became a Christian for about 2 years, and his wife made an observation to me once. And she said, and this is in the second chapter of the book on tactics, she said, you know, when I go to talk to people about the Lord, Jesus said in John chapter 10, my sheep hear my voice. Now, this is a deeply misunderstood passage by many people because they think it's about hearing the voice of God. It has absolutely nothing to do with Christians hearing the voice of God. It has to do with non-Christians being influenced by the Holy Spirit to come to Christ. That's what he's talking about. Read the context. My sheep, those that are mine, they hear me and they follow me and I give them eternal life is what he says. But the applicational point here is, she knows that there are some people that God is going to be working in their life and other people he's not going to be working. If he's not working in their life, forget about it. It's just not going to happen. They're lost. They're unplugged from God. They're not, they got the devil blind in their eyes. He's in control of their lives. You're not going to get him. God's got to get him, okay? And it may not be at that moment that God's working, okay? And here's what she said, though, going back to the sheep hear my voice. She said, sometimes I start to talk to somebody and I'll notice that sometimes the sheep lifts his head. The sheep lifts his head. You ever notice that you're talking, and there's a sign of interest. There's like a little glint in the eye. There's just something going on, and they show interest in what you're talking about. She said, other times, they just keep eating grass. If the sheep is eating grass, I'm not going to push it any further. They're not interested. Why should I annoy them anymore? Okay? But if they lift their head, if they show an interest in some way, and sometimes maybe even it'll look like a little bit of a hostile interest, but it's still an interest, well, then we can move forward, okay? So we don't know that until we start to get into play into a circumstance. So I'm saying in your game plan, your first step, you're not looking way ahead. You're just looking at the first step. That's all you worry about, okay? Now, this game plan involves asking questions, okay? And I mentioned yesterday that there are three uses two questions that I've identified and employed in this game plan. That makes three steps, okay? So what is the first step of our game plan? The first thing we think about, the first thing we use our questions to accomplish. Here it is, okay? The first thing we do in our game plan is we gather information. That's all we're concerned about out of the gate. Columbo shows up in the crime scene. There's a dead body. How do you solve the crime? Can't move forward until you get what? Intel. You got to know a few things. You got to find out the lay of the land. And that's the case with the individual you're talking to. Are they Christian? Are they non-Christian? If they're not a Christian, why not? Do they care? Have they heard the gospel? Have they not? See, these are things you don't know. And these are things that you may be able to discover by talking to them. Okay, so your first goal is to simply use questions to draw another person out, and you're going to be looking generally for two kinds of information. You're going to be looking for personal information and for spiritual information. Now, if you're a total stranger, you're sitting down next to somebody on the airplane, you're going to start with personal information, just friendly stuff. You're not going to, you know, ask them, hey, you've been washed in the blood, you know, or anything like that right out of the gate. You're just going to be friendly. But as you're able, you want to keep your be alert for opportunities to maybe move into a spiritual area and gather some spiritual information. Okay, so let me give you some examples of how this would work. And I'm going to give you a model question in a minute that you can employ that will help you to do that. In fact, for the first two uses of Columbo, there are model questions. For the third use of Columbo, there's not a specific question because it's a little more advanced, and I'll explain that to you tomorrow, okay? Illustration, okay. So I'm on an airplane, and I'm sitting next to a guy whose name is John. How do I know his name is John? I introduce myself. Hi, I'm Greg. Oh, I'm John. Nice to see you. Where are you headed? Oh, I know where you're headed. We're on the same plane together. Ah. You going home? Going to work? Going home. Yeah, I'm going to work. Really, what do you do? Oh, I'm a speaker, public talk show host, a writer. I'll say this, you know. So I'm thinking, good, I'm glad. I try to make it as exotic sounding as possible on my part because I want them to ask me, what do you write about? What do you speak about? You know, that kind of thing. And then I have an opportunity to then maybe move into something. That kind of opens the door a little bit for maybe talking about something spiritual. Now, just as an aside, on this particular flight, as I got on the plane, it was a morning flight, and can't work on my computer when you're taking off. So I grabbed my Bible and I read my Bible a little bit. Now, I just so you know, look, I don't read my Bible all the time on the airplane, okay? I'm not like super spiritual like that. Plus, I don't open my Bible and I use it as a prop. You know, it isn't like so people will see me. And then they might think, either he's really spiritual or maybe I can, you know, I'm not trying to, anybody got any questions? You know, that's not what I'm doing. My way of approaching these kinds of public displays of my faith, whether it's like giving thanks at a dinner, at a restaurant, or reading your Bible, I do what I want to do. If I'm at dinner, I give thanks. If I'm with my family, we hold hands, we bow our heads, I give thanks. If I'm with my staff, and we got 10 or 15 or 20 people at the table, I stand up in the restaurant and I give thanks to the table. Now, I'm not trying to be so loud that I'm rude, but I don't, first of all, I don't want to not do that, like not be visible about that because I'm embarrassed. I'm not embarrassed to give thanks to God. I want people to see I'm not embarrassed to show that I love the Lord and willing to give thanks. Secondly, I hope it'll have a salutary effect on people. And I've had people that come up to me and said, gee, that's really neat. You know, I'm glad you did that, you know. Or one guy, remember this, my wife's back there. We were in a Mexican restaurant and the waiter stood by the side here and waited till we done. And he came up, he took a knee and he said, can you teach me to do what you just did? Because I want to pray like that with my own kids. Remember that, honey? Man, it was at Cisco's restaurant. So, and the same thing with the Bible in the morning. If I want to read it, I'm going to read it. Now more and more people get bugged at that kind of thing, you know. But if somebody says, you know, I'm offended, I'm going to say, why are you offended? By the way, notice that's a, what kind of phrase was that? That was a question? Why are you offended? Well, I don't believe in that stuff. I don't like that stuff. I said, okay, then don't read that stuff. That's no good reason for me not to read it. You know, I don't get it. Anyway, so this morning, that particular morning, I'm on there with John. I'm reading, close the Bible. We get to talking. And he mentions that he's not a Christian. Is that a good information for me to know? Absolutely. Then he says, I actually used to be a Christian, but I'm not anymore. Is that good information? He said, actually, I used to be a preacher's kid. I said, John, how do you used to be a preacher's kid? Did your dad die? He said, no, my dad didn't die. My dad's just no longer a preacher. Oh, I got it. In fact, my dad's no longer a Christian. Oh, do you think there's some baggage sitting here next to me on that airplane? Oh, my gosh. And as we talked some more and all I did was draw him out, I wanted to hear his story. Man, he laid into me, not laid into me, but he just let it out. And he was pretty upset. And he had a lot of bad experiences with Christians. Can you imagine, by the way, if I had just jumped into a conversation with him about Jesus and started giving him the gospel, how would he have responded to me? Remember, Paul said, so you know how to respond to each person. If I just jumped in like that, what would he have said? I've been there, I've done that, and it hurt. No, that would not have been effective. As it was, I just listened to him. And, you know, he got at one point in his conversation, and he said to me, he said, you know, guys like you. I'm thinking, moi? What do you mean, guys like me? He said, guys who read Bibles on airplanes, that's what he's talking about. You're kind of Christian. Guys like you would be really upset at me based on what I've said, but you're not angry at me. You're not upset, and I appreciate that. Now, I just want you to think about that for a moment. See, because he's mad at Christians, but I'm not taking it personal. I'm not defensive, partly because I know that, you know, there are a lot of nasty Christians. I mean, let's face it, we're a broken group of people, all right? So this happens. I'm not surprised, okay? But do you think the fact that I was just there, not beating up on him, but just graciously listening to his story, do you think that all by itself might have a salutary effect on him, might be a stone in his shoe? What do you think? Absolutely. And what did I have to do? I didn't have to do anything. Did I have to know apologetics? Did I have to know theology? No, I didn't have to know that. I was just being a good, nice person to him in that circumstance, just listening. But I'm getting information because the more he talks, the more I'm able to see kind of a spiritual topography in my mind's eye here about for John. And I realize, oh man, there's some minefields out there. And guess what? Now I can maneuver around the minefields and not make a mess of things, hopefully. By the time he got off that airplane, I had his email address in my pocket. Is that trust? Absolutely. How'd that happen? Well, at one point, he started talking about things that he'd read about how the Bible's been changed and translated and retranslated. You can't trust it anymore. Bart Ehrman stuff, you know, Jesus, misquoting Jesus and the like. These are books that are out there. And it raised a question in his own mind about the legitimacy or reliability of the Bible. I said, well, you know, I've actually written an article on that. Would you be interested in seeing it? And he said, yes. I said, where should I send it? He gave me his email address. I got to my destination, got to my hotel, downloaded the article, sent it to his email. Just a little quick note. The next morning, he sent a thank you note, and that was it. I have never heard from him since. Now, some people say, well, why? You didn't go after him? You didn't call him? You didn't pursue him? You didn't follow up? No, this guy's already had bad experiences with Christian. I don't want to give him another bad experience. I'd given him one good experience, and I left something with him to get him thinking. And it has our, you know, website there in the footer. So I'm covered, right? What did I do? I just did a little gardening, and I left the rest to God. Because I'm not the only player on the team. I got a whole bunch of other players there, okay? So I'm just drawing him out to learn a little bit about him, and I'm just listening for an opportunity. Now, I'll tell you something interesting about how the Holy Spirit works here. It's not always easy to know how these things are going to develop. And I have been in circumstances when, to be honest, I was not particularly interested in talking to anybody, which is actually the case a lot of times. You know, I'm in my own little world, I'm working, I'm tired, whatever. But my attitude is, your servant, Lord. Your servant, Lord. That is, I want, even if I'm a little bit reluctant, shall we say, in my flesh, I still want to have an attitude of being available to God. And it's amazing how often God will take that circumstance and he will use it, he will transform it. And I'm sitting there wondering, how did this happen, this wonderful conversation? I don't remember how I got there. I remember one case, I was on the airplane, it was a pretty full airplane, and people are packing in, it's almost loaded, and there's like one seat left, and it's the one next to me. Well, there's a couple others. But anyway, so this young man is walking down the aisle, okay? And he's, I'd say, about 23 years old. He's a black fella, young man, with one of these baseball caps on, and he's got all this, his trousers were kind of down a bit, and he's got all this stuff hanging on, and all, you know, it's like, just want to tell you, I have nothing against young people or black people. This guy was not in my cultural niche at all. I'm just saying, all right? And so I was praying for him. And I said, Lord, please do not let that young man sit next to me. I was. And as usual, God did not answer my prayer. He sat down right next to me. It was hard to imagine somebody that was more unlikely for me, you know, to sit next to and talk to about Christ, okay? And I, within 15 minutes, we were talking about the Lord. Do not ask me, I mean, I can hardly remember how that conversation went. But it is just amazing when you're available and you begin to initiate your game plan and draw people out and just be friendly with people, what God begins to do. You just get into the batter's box and keep your eyes open, watch for a pitch that you can take a swing at, okay? So the first use of Columbo, the first step of the game plan is to gather information. And you want two kinds of information, basically personal stuff, but you want to keep your eye open for spiritual things that may come up. Maybe they'll never come up, that's all right. Now here's the first model question. What do you mean by that? What do you mean by that? Now this is a very, very flexible question. It can be used in lots of different ways. And last night, I told an anecdote about my wife and I talking to a young lady at a counter who was processing some film for me, making digitizing some film a while back. And she had a pentagram around her neck, a five-pointed star, which is an occultic symbol much of the time. And so I asked her about her symbol. I said, does that jewelry have religious significance. And then last night I relayed where that conversation led, which was very interesting, I think. The point is, though, my opening salvo, the entree into the conversation that went in somewhat spiritual directions, was a question about her jewelry. I was essentially saying, what do you mean by that jewelry? If anything, maybe you don't mean anything by it, you know, but turned out she was a witch. So that's why she was wearing the pagan symbol, you know, the occultic star there. And so we got into a conversation. But it started because I just asked a simple question. And a lot of times there might be somebody reading a book. Hey, what are you reading? What's that? What's going on there? What's it about? You know, what do you mean by that? Okay. Now, there are going to be times when you are actually going to be engaged in a conversation. And this is where I use this question most often. And people are going to be raising issues regarding Christianity. So let's just say you're already engaged, and maybe you have friends you already talk with, and you haven't been very productive with it because you don't know how to deal with the pushback, okay? This question is pure gold. What do you mean by that? Because it is almost always the case when somebody offers up an alternate view or a pushback on Christianity that there's some ambiguity in what they're saying. All right. And what you want to do is you want to flesh out the ambiguities. You want to get clarity. You want them to give you clarity on their point of view. Okay. So here's an example. I was at Summit Ministries a number of years ago in Colorado Springs. And a young Christian came up and said, I have a friend who confronted me about Christianity. And what the friend said was, everything's relative. He said, now how do I deal with that argument? I said, well, first of all, it's not an argument. It's just a statement, okay? But, listen, I've written a book on relativism. I know all about relativism, and I'm fully capable of dealing with that kind of challenge, but I would never take that challenge, even with my background, head on. Instead, I'm going to use my tactical approach. So what do you think I'm going to say? If that person says to me everything's relative, what do you think the next words out of my mouth are going to be? What do you mean by that? Absolutely. Now, do you notice what I just did? If I would have picked anybody in this audience, just about anybody, and said to you, I'm going to be the non-Christian, and here's what I'm saying to you. You believe you have the truth, everything's relative. You're next. You know, I know what you'd feel. You go, most of you go, I don't know what to say next. How about this? What do you mean by that? Now where does the pressure go and the attention go? Boom, right onto the other person. You're off the hook immediately, just like that. And there's massive ambiguity in the statement. Because the way I might put it is, well, what do you mean by relative? Now, I know what relativism is, like I said. But that doesn't mean he knows what relativism is. I'm going to give you an insight. You talk to people out there about spiritual things. What you find most of the time is that people have not thought through hardly anything that they say they believe. What's happened is they have been socialized by their culture to say certain things. Do you know how many, just generally in culture now, how many issues or things come up where the stock response is, that's racist? It's all over the place now. I guarantee you the person who says that's racist has no idea what racism is. Or bigotry, for that matter, which is another one they use. They've never thought about it. They don't even know. They just know this is a way to silence people. I don't like their opinions. I just call them a name. Okay, now it's really bad manners, but it's what people do. Okay, and so this person who says everything's relative, he's probably heard that from somebody else. He's never thought about it. So I'm going to ask him, what do you mean by relative? And see what he has to say. Now, he might have some explanation. Okay, fine. Now, now at least I understand a little bit what he's after. But if he explains to me what he means by relative, I have another question. Because his statement was what? What was his statement? Everything's relative. I asked him, what do you mean by relative? I got another question here. What's that? What do you mean by everything? Well, what do you mean? Everything is everything, right? What's so hard about that? Well, wait a minute. If everything in your statement means everything, isn't the statement everything's relative part of everything? Right? Which would make the statement itself what? Relative. See a little problem there maybe? Okay, this might be going over some people's heads. That's okay. But what's going on here is the suicide tactic is beginning to stick its nose under the tent here, you know, that sometimes people make statements that are just self-refuting. They destroy themselves. Well, if everything's relative, then your statement is relative, right? Huh? Okay, so the point here is I'm going to use the question to make the other person flesh out their objection, and I'm going to listen to what they have to say. Okay, now I'll tell you a secret here. Sometimes what you get when you ask the person, what do you mean by that? In light of the fact that many people are just repeating slogans they've heard, and Christians do this too, by the way, sometimes what you're going to get is what I call the Simon and Garfunkel response. Can you remember these guys back in the 60s? It's a great duet. I mean, they just have absolutely fabulous music. And I understand they're experienced a little revival in interest, which I think is great. But and they're both still alive, but they're really old. But they wrote a song back in 1966, and the title was The Sounds of Silence. And so when you ask somebody, what do you mean by that? Sometimes you get the sounds of silence. In other words, they have no response, which is really odd when you think about it, because they're pushing back against Christianity and they're giving it to you like this, and they're after, and then you say, well, what do you mean by that? And they go, you'd think they know what they mean, but see, this just trades on the notion that people do not think very much about their ideas in our culture nowadays. They emote about them, but they don't think about them. Now, it's not to put people down, but it's just to help you to know that what you want people to do, if we're going to have a conversation about something really important, like spiritual things, you don't want to just emote about things. You want to get to the facts. You want to find out what's true about this. I mean, it's like in medicine. We got a doctor right here, you know. He doesn't just go by feelings. He's the doctor on the... If you get hurt this week, this is the guy that's going to fix you up. Is that right?
Maybe.
Okay. All right. He got banged up himself here. He took a fall. But he'll take care of you. No, he doesn't go by his feelings. He's got to go by the facts, because physical health is important. Spiritual health is like that too. Can't just go by feelings, but people are going by feelings mostly, including Christians a lot. That's why we get Christians get in trouble too. So we want to make sure, as we draw the person out, we want to make sure that they are talking about that they are being more precise and specific about their own ideas, okay? So let me give you some more examples of how this works out. Wait, I have this thing called my notes here. I probably should look at once in a while. Okay, so somebody says, there is no God. Really? What do you mean by that? What do you mean? What do I mean by that? There's no God. Well, what kind of God don't you believe in? Some people don't believe in a God that's an old guy with a beard that's on a throne up in the outer space somewhere. Well, I don't believe in that kind of God either. All right, it's good to know if that's what you're talking about. I'm with you on that one. Anyway, that's not God. That's Father Time. If you look around the throne, there's a sickle kind of leaning up the back. Maybe they don't believe in a God of personal religion. They might be a nun, N-O-N-E, which a lot of folks are. No religious conviction, but they're spiritual, but not religious. So they don't believe in our God, organized religion. I actually said this when I was a non-Christian. I don't believe in organized religion. Now I think, you know, if I couldn't get together with a bunch of other guys or people who had the same conviction. Let's all have coffee and talk about it. Then we'd be organized. We got to stay disorganized, right? Maybe disorganized religion is better. But so maybe that's their view. I don't know. When they say they don't believe in God, that's what they mean. Maybe they're materialists like Richard Dawkins or Christopher Hitchens or the New Atheists, and they don't believe in anything outside of the material realm. You know, the cosmos is all there is, ever was or ever will be, Carl Sagan. You know, maybe that's, but it's helpful for me to know where they're at. Oh, I'm an agnostic. Really, what kind of agnostic are you? There's two basic kinds. One kind says, I don't know. That's an agnostic. One, another kind says, I don't know, and nobody could know. Well, that's a different kind of agnostic. Say, now I happen to know that, so I can say, what kind are you? What do you mean by that? Then I make, you see what I'm doing is I'm trying to toss the ball back into their court as much as I possibly can and let them do as much talking as possible and let them force them to articulate their own views as clearly as possible. I get more information to deal with and they have to do more of the work. The pressure's not on me, it's on them. Now, I'm not trying to make them feel uncomfortable, that's not the point, but it's a tactical maneuver to keep me from shouldering all the responsibility and also provide clarity in the conversation. So I got a call on radio, I've been doing talk radio for 27 years. I got a call and somebody called in and said, can you recommend a good book on Buddhism? I said, why do you want a book on Buddhism? Okay, what is that? So what do you mean by that? See that? Oh, he says, well, I have a friend who's a Buddhist I work with, and I want to talk to him about Christ, so I want to read a book on Buddhism. I said, okay, this is a bad idea. It's a bad idea to buy the book. Now I know why he wants it, okay? Don't buy the book. It costs you money, you got to read it. And chances are it's not the Buddhism he believes in anyway. He's an American. They're all messed up when they think about religion, okay? They pick and choose like, so don't forget about that. I said, instead, grab your buddy, take him down to the local watering hole, buy him a latte, and ask him. I understand you're a Buddhist, right? Wow, I don't know anything about Buddhism. I'm a Christian. Can you tell me about your Buddhism? Now, what's going to happen? You're going to get a free education, except for the cost of your latte, and you're going to be doing it in the process of having a conversation and building a relationship with the very person that you want to share Christ with, right? Wow, what a country. See how easy that is? And look, if you're, you know, don't just jump on him 10 sentences later and say, okay, let me tell you about Christianity. You work with the guy, so you got some time here. Chances are, if you're willing to listen to him, then he'll be willing to listen to you, and that gives the Holy Spirit some room to work. All right? Okay, so I got a call on the radio? What do you mean by that? Okay. How about this one? You shouldn't be forcing your views on me. How many have ever heard that one before? You should force your views on me. So what am I going to say? What do you mean? What do you mean? Well, now I want them to... Now, this is a very popular ploy to silence the Christian, okay? We're forcing our views. You're intolerant, another way of putting it, you know. What do you mean intolerant? Oh, you think you're right. What do you think? Do you think that I think I'm right when I talk to other people? Yeah, of course I think I'm right. I wouldn't believe, if I didn't think my beliefs were true, I wouldn't believe what I believe. I would believe something else. And think that was true. Okay, now here's the payoff. Just like everybody else, including the person you're talking to. So when he says you're intolerant, you're forcing your views on me, and I say, what do you mean by that? Well, you think you're right. You think I'm wrong and you're right. Yeah, I do. And I could be mistaken. I'm glad to talk about it, but what about you? The views that you have contrary to mine, do you think your views are right? Okay, that's a question, right? I'm just getting clarification. What is he going to say?
No, all my beliefs are false.
No, of course they think their views are right. Now, somebody might do the postmodern two-step on you and say, well, my beliefs are true for me. I said, okay, if they're true for you, then why are you talking to me right now? The reason they're talking with you is they're trying to persuade you of their view. They want you to be tolerant like them because they think their tolerant view is correct. You're the intolerant one because you think other people are wrong. But in order to make the point, they've got to say you are what? Wrong. He's doing the very thing he's telling you not to do. That's suicide. Okay, so there's that other tactic in there. I got a couple of chapters just on the suicide tactic. You see, though, how I was able to get there just by asking the questions to draw them out a little bit more for clarification's sake. And then in some ways, sometimes they just sink their own ship. So let's check where we're at here. Okay. The first application, you want to gather information. Okay. By the way, just a little insight on this intolerance deal, when people say you're intolerant, all that's going on there is simple name calling. That's all it is. They call you racist. They call you intolerant. They call you a bigot. All they're doing, they've changed the subject and they're calling you a name. You're talking about same-sex marriage. You're talking about gender issues. You're talking about anything else. All of a sudden, boom, you're intolerant. You're a bigot. Why'd you change the subject? What'd you mean? Well, we were just talking about this topic and now we're talking about my personality. Do you see that? That's a different topic. By the way, could I be a bigot? Sure. Could I be a bigot who is right on the issue that we're discussing? I could be a bigot who's right. I could be a bigot who's not right. He could be tolerant who's right. He could be tolerant who's wrong. Whether I'm a bigot or not has nothing to do with the merits of my point of view. It's a distraction. What if the person said, well, you're a bigot? I said, and you're ugly. Your mother dresses you funny. Now, I wouldn't say that because it wouldn't be polite and it's irrelevant to the issue. What I'm trying to get them to see is they've gotten off the track and now they're just talking about something else. They're going after my character. You attack my character, I attack your looks. All right, so now neither of us are talking about anything meaningful anymore. We're just being obnoxious. I want people to think about getting back to the issue instead of being obnoxious. I'll tell you something, it is very difficult to get people on the track nowadays because now that you've been more alerted to this, you will notice virtually every single discussion you see in the public square amounts to nothing more than semi-sophisticated name-calling, and that's it. Now, if you study informal fallacies, there's a name for that kind of thing. Anybody know what it is? It's called ad hominem or to the man. That means you attack the person instead of the idea. It's nonsense, it's bad thinking, and it's bad manners, but people do it all the time, from the least to the greatest. And this is why in our culture it's so rampant, because people that are looked up to, they do this kind of thing. So we don't want to repeat that kind of thing. And when we see it, we want to find a way to expose it to people. This happened to me on actually a TV show in Canada, a national TV show. Exact same thing happened. And I pointed that particular thing out to them. It was kind of fun. But let's see, what else do I want to say here before we... sounds of silence. Okay, this first question is really fabulous because it keeps you in a certain sense in a neutral position. There's no pressure on you. You can ask this question all day long until the cows come home. What do you mean by that? And the other person gets to do the talking, but you're listening to gather valuable information. Now, there is a little liability to it. So gentlemen, if your wives call you an idiot, don't say, what do you mean by that? All right. She just might explain. All right. Okay, I'm just looking to see where I want to go next. So this is the first step of the game plan. I think I want to just see if there's any questions right now. We got about 10 more minutes and yeah. What happens then? If there's sounds of silence, you let it sit. You don't let them off the hook, okay? Because the silence, you ask them a legitimate question, what do you mean by that? And they don't know how to answer it. Well, don't take the pressure off. If you know how in sales, sometimes you got that circumstance, they say the next one who speaks loses. You want to let that sink in a little bit. Let them feel the discomfort of it. You know, and then try the best maybe to draw them out in a little bit different way to try to understand their view. But don't rescue them too quickly. They've made an assertion that they're very confident of, but then when you ask for clarification, they don't know what to say. Well, that's crazy. Yeah.
When you encounter the ad hominem,
right.
Yeah. Do you try to point that out to them? I mean, like, it some point, you just so I think we're done here.
Yeah. There is a place where you can say, the question was, when somebody starts attacking you personally, how do you deal with that? Do you just kind of bail out sometimes, or you point it out? I think it's appropriate to point it out, but you got to do it nicely. And sometimes there's a propriety to just leaving the conversation. I talk about that in the steamroller tactic. Not everybody deserves an answer. And some people are just so unpleasant and obnoxious, there is no progress going to be made in a conversation. And especially if they interrupt a lot, you know, okay, I give a technique to deal with that. That's the steamroller tactic. And it's very effective. But some people, you just get to the point where you just got to leave them. Okay. Now, if somebody is doing the ad hominem, it's good to have some things in your back pocket to say. I offered one of them already. Did they may catch the question I used? When somebody says, use the ad hominem, you're intolerant, you're racist, whatever. I asked a question. They may catch it. Why did you change the subject? Thank you. Why did you change the topic? Okay. Now, notice, I could have said, you just changed the topic. You're attacking me. Now, what is that? That's a dead end. Because now I'm accusing them. But when I ask, why did you change the topic, I'm tossing the ball back into their court, and now it's their chance to respond. And you'll see an advantage of the questions. If you make statements, if you just make statements, they can either come out hostile or contrary, and the response could be hostile and equally contrary. Statements can easily be gainsaid. In other words, they could say, oh, no, it's not. Yes, it is. No, it's not. Yes, it is. See, okay, so that's not helpful. But if you use the question appropriate to the circumstances, well, then the ball's in their court. Now they have to respond. Why did you change the topic, maybe? One statement, though, I think it can be helpful, especially if you're dealing with a larger audience and you get a lot of this, is ridicule's not an argument. I mean, that's a statement. But it does put things in its proper perspective. Ridicule is not an argument. Do you have something substantive to offer than just name-calling? Now, there was a fellow that called the show. This was about 15 years ago. A homosexual guy asked my opinions about homosexuality. I gave my thoughts on it, and he got angry at me. And he called me a homophobe. Okay? Now, there's the move. There's the ad hominem. All right? I said, look, when you got on the air, I didn't call you a fag or a fairy or queer or any of that stuff, okay? I don't believe in that kind of thing, okay? And I don't allow that kind of stuff on my show. So you can't call me names, because I'm not calling you names. If you have something substantive to contribute, I'll listen to it. If you don't, I'll move on to another caller. So what's it going to be? Now, you can do that when you got your own show, because it's my show, I can tell what to do. But you can make your adaptation, you know, to... The same thing could be done just in a standard conversation. You want to make a contribution? Fine. You want to beat me up? You want to call me names? No. It's not good for either of us. So what's it going to be? And notice the question. Toss it back into their court. Yes? Right.
And what you're doing is wringing the towel. All the wetness is coming out slowly, and you're drawing it out.
Right.
You're getting all these things out of the way, so at one point, they're not going to have a whole lot more to say. A lot of these people really don't have a whole lot to say, like you said. And when you get all their information out, which sometimes they didn't take that long, they're more apt to listen.
Yeah, that's good. The point was being made is sometimes they don't have a lot to say, and when you ask the question, you're kind of wringing out the towel. You're getting every bit that they have, and then they don't have much more to say. You get as much as you can. Sometimes they do have more to say, but a lot of times it's not substantive. And so they'll make another comment, and then you see opportunities for asking more clarification questions about what they've said. So any ambiguity, look, there are so many points of view that gain traction in the cultural discussion based on the ambiguity. Okay, look, at people who are against same-sex marriage. Oh, you don't believe in marriage equality. Okay, so that's the slogan. That's the meme, right? Boom. When I heard that, I thought to myself, I got to figure out a way to respond to that because that's powerful. You notice how the rhetoric works there. And so my response is, do you believe that children should be married? No. Well, then you don't believe in marriage equality either. right? Oh, well, that's different. Okay, so now we've just established, by doing that move there, we've at least got on the table that the liberty to marry is not unrestricted. There are restrictions that are appropriate. What I'm trying to do there is to get past that rhetorical move, you know, because that's powerful. Oh, you don't believe in marriage equality. Well, do you? Yeah. Do you believe in children should be married? Well, no. Well, that's different. Oh, okay. Then what are the differences that matter? And so, see, these are questions meant to maneuver. Now, in some of these cases, like what I just offered you, I didn't think of that on my feet. It isn't like I'm, you know, on TV and somebody slams me with that and I go, well, I'm clever, I can do this. No, you got to work on this, some of these things on your own. And the way you do it is you got to get blindsided and, you know, stonewalled a bunch of times, you know, then you figure out, I better do something about that one. And then you work it out, and the next time you do a little bit better. But this is all part of the growth process. Yeah. Yes, sir.
You mentioned last night or yesterday that if you get mad,
oh, yeah. You lose. If I get mad, I lose, right. If anybody gets mad, I lose.
I mean, just, I guess being honest, personally, I have a tendency to get mad.
Yeah.
So, what are some practical tips? We pray about it. We want to have the right spirit.
Yeah. Yeah.
But when it gets, when you're in an argument, when you're in a discussion with someone,
yeah.
There really is a tendency to get
emotional. So how do I keep from, how do I deal with that? Okay. It is easy, especially for certain personalities, to get kind of wound up and intense and angry in that mode in these kind of conversations. And then they cease being productive. So the question is, what do I do personally? And I'm a lot like that. You know, my wife knows. She's like, I got to tell you the truth. She wasn't here. I could tell you any story at all, but she's sitting in the back. So I can get that way, you know. So these are times where if you instruct yourself that if I get mad, I lose. So if you tell yourself, that's why I tell you this. It's a little aphorism. It's easy to remember. I'm going to lose here. I'm not going to accomplish anything productive that I want to accomplish. That's what I mean by lose. Then that helps instruct us to assess and slow down. So what do I need to do? I need to stop myself from speaking, okay, in that moment. Give myself a few beats. If I just boom, 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 then I'm going to get in trouble, okay? Proverbs says, he who restrains his lips is wise. He who opens wide his mouth comes to ruin. Okay, that's one of a bunch of them in there. Now, why do I know that proverb? Yeah. Okay, so there's a discipline where you just, okay, you just stop. Maybe that's the best way to say it. You just got to, you feel it, just stop. Stop talking. Take a breath. Ease into it. The tendency, too, is to want to interrupt. Boom, boom. That's steamroller. Okay, you don't want a steamroller. It's bad when people do it to you. You don't want to do it to other people. Okay, take a breath. Listen. Yeah, in the back.
So, if you get stonewalled, what's the best approach at that point?
Well, sometimes, you know, when you're stonewalled, like you don't know how to respond, you just kind of eat it in the moment. I mean, you can't. Sometimes there's no graceful way out of being bested in a conversation, okay? But you know how the saying goes, fool me once, shame on you, fool me twice, shame on me, kind of thing. So when those things happen, that's a good time, and I talk about this in the book, How to Improve Your Columbo Tactic. That's a good time to take an assessment afterwards about what you might have said or how you might have avoided that circumstance, okay? The best time to think of good ways of interacting and responding, good questions to ask the things that come up, is when the pressure's off. And the pressure's off in two times, before and after, okay? So sometimes if you know the kind of thing that you might encounter, you might want to think in advance of what you're going to say. So if somebody says to me, I just know this now for myself, well, what about the problem of evil? they're raising this against me in Christianity. I say, what about it? Well, that's a problem for you, isn't it? How so? Well, and what I want them to do is spell out the problem. Now, I know that it looks like a problem to the people, but it's not a problem for us. It's actually a tremendous strength. I hinted at that on Sunday morning, yesterday morning a little bit. And you read about that in the story of reality, the material I talked about yesterday. I wrote a book about it. It came out. Somebody had it here yesterday, but it came out in January. But I developed this idea that the problem of evil is a great asset for us because it's a real part of the world, and we can explain where it came from and what the solution is. Where others who raise the objection, typically atheists, can't even make sense of the question they're asking. Because then I'm going to say, what do you mean by evil? And they might say, well, you know, like rape and murdering and pillaging and George Bush and, you know, that kind of stuff. And no, I don't. I should say Donald Trump now. I don't know. But what people would say. And secondhand smoke, whatever. I say, wait, you've just given me examples of evil. You haven't told me what evil is. Why would you call those things evil rather than say what Mother Teresa did? Call that evil. So you have to have a concept of evil already before you can identify action examples of it. So that's what I'm getting at. And see, what evil is that things aren't the way they're supposed to be. But as I said yesterday, you can't have a way that things are supposed, you can't have a circumstance where they're not the way they're supposed to be unless there is a way they're supposed to be, and you can't have that without a sposer. All right, so people are chuckling now. Weren't at the sermon yesterday, I could tell that, because I get told that. But that's insightful. You've got, if there is no God, there is no way things are supposed to be. There is no problem of evil. There can't be a problem of evil. Things cannot be evil in that view. It's just stuff happens. That's it. There cannot be value judgments because you need a standard over everything that allows you to judge the events that we call evil. But with no God, there's no standard. And in evolution, I'm just going to tell you right now, I don't have time to get into it. It's not going to do that for you. It cannot give you... Evolution cannot make rape wrong. It can just make people think rape is wrong when rape is benign. Okay? Only God could give you the standard. So the existence of evil in the world turns out to be one of the best arguments in favor of the existence of God, not against the existence of God. Oh, I'll be talking about that on Thursday night. Thursday I'm going to talk about bad arguments against God. So I'll get into that in a little more detail. So I've tipped my hand a little bit about Thursday. But so notice, though, I've got a series of questions that I ask as somebody's coming back at me, and I'm dumping the whole issue right back in their lap. They've got something to answer for, too, on this issue. Now, I've been doing this a long time, so I can make a lot more progress on these things than most of you can. But I want you to think about this, and we probably should... Yeah, we should call it quits for tonight. But what I want you to think about is just, you know, for the next month or so, in your conversations with other people of a spiritual nature, be a student. Just be a student. You're not going to try to win people to Christ, close the deal, anything. Just start drawing people out to understand their own convictions about things. And whenever they say anything, it might lead to another question. You're just going to be a student. Practice just the first step of the game plan. And I promise you, if you do this, it's going to be easy. I'm just saying, this is easy. People like to talk about their views, especially Muslims, by the way, just as a point of information. And you're not crowding them. You're not giving them a hard time. You're just getting clarification. You're going to get an education. And there's two things that are going to stand out for you. You're going to find out that those people who are not Christians, those other folks, those scary people on the other side of the spiritual fence, they are not as scary as you thought. There's a simple little rule I learned when I debated Michael Shermer. Michael Shermer, the American Atheist, Skeptic Magazine. I did 3 hours of debate on national radio with him. And it was nerve-wracking. But I realize that the more you get close to a person, the less frightening they become. So I started listening to his debates and a lot of his stuff, you know, and reading his books and stuff. And the more you're familiar with them, the less frightening they are. It's just a natural thing. So you're going to find out they're not as scary as you thought. The second thing you're going to find out is they're not as smart as you thought. And again, this is not a put down on people. It's just that we, remember Numbers, you know, when they sent the 12 spies into the land and 10 of the spies came back and said, yeah, it's flowing with fruit and, you know, milk and honey, but there are giants in the land. And we were, listen to, we were like grasshoppers in our own sight. Did you catch that? That's what they said. We were like grasshoppers in our own sight. You know, Joshua, Caleb said, forget about it. God will give them, let's go do it, you know. But no, they had over-exaggerated the threat to them. And they were totally ineffective. And we can do that too. I do it. So when we engage people more and talk with them more and let them speak about their own point of view, we'll find out they're not as scary as we thought, but they're not as smart as we thought too. They don't have these great objections against Christianity. They probably don't have, I mean, sometimes they'll have a substantive thing to say, but you'll be surprised at how little you find that. So I encourage you to make that a commitment, say the next month, just be a student of other people's views and just make mental record of what they say. And then tomorrow, when we come back, you'll all come back, tomorrow night, 7, we will talk about the next two steps of Columbo. And that are the second use of Columbo and the third use of Columbo. And that'll be some fun, I think. I'll show you how to do it. Okay? Thanks.